I thought these folks come in. Yeah, I'm Michael. I work at IBM in Canberra. My day job is I'm a kernel hacker. Specifically, for the last 2 years, I've been on the cell kernel team, and also do just general PowerPC stuff. Never. Did I? Oh, I did, yes. No heckling. You're right. So I've been working for 2 years on the cell processor, but if you know anything about it, the kernel basically just runs on the PPE. So I've never really had much fun with this amazing cell processor. So this is why I'm doing this talk. I'm not quite sure how to pitch this. I'm not sure if you're all techies or if you're all graphics people or if you're whatever. So I'm going to try and go from an overview right through to the technical stuff at the end. So if I lose some of you at the end, I'm sorry. And if the start's boring for Arndt, then bad luck. There's a little bit of bling. The bling. So the cell processor. It's been around for a few years now. They started in 2001, I think, working on it. It was a joint venture between Sony, Toshiba, and IBM. And they sort of got all these engineers and stuck them in Austin, Texas for 4 years and didn't let them out. And on the other end, they got a processor. They were developing it with the PlayStation 3 in mind. And Toshiba was also interested in, you know, media intensive stuff, video processing, and IBM was interested in it as a HPC kind of part, a really fast processor. I think it doesn't work. There we go. Okay. They actually developed an architecture, not just a processor. This is meant to have little trademark symbols, but that didn't work. So it's the Cell Broadband Engine trademark processor, and it's an implementation of the Cell Broadband Engine architecture, all of which is trademarked by Sony. I have to tell you that for legal reasons, but I'm going to call it the cell processor. We're meant to call it that, but you know what I mean. It is interesting, though, to note that it's an architecture because this is the cell processor now, but there will be other ones. Toshiba already have one they're calling the Spurs engine, which has four SPEs, and, you know, so it's an architecture that's going to keep going and grow, and there'll be new chips. I wrote this, and then I thought, is cell interesting? And had a little panic attack, but you all came, so I guess it is. Or you were just here already. So we've had this, for all of my programming life, we've had this lovely progression of new Intel chips coming out every year or 2 years that are three times faster than the previous one. And, you know, what's the Andy Giveth and Bill Peckers way? So Windows gets slower just as fast as Intel chips get faster. But that's looking like it might be coming to an end. So this, when I was a kid, you know, this is what you had. You didn't even have an FPU back in the day. But, you know, there was a CPU, and no Amiga fans, go away, I don't want to hear it from you. There was a CPU, and that's all there was to it. I'm talking sort of desktop processors here. So, you know, some of this stuff arrived earlier in high-end, but I'm talking about the processors that most programmers are familiar with, so the stuff in your laptops. So in the early 2000s, we got dual-thread, multi-threaded stuff. These days, you're seeing dual core parts in, you know, mainstream stuff. My laptop has one, a bunch of you will. There's quad core stuff coming. I don't know if they're doing that in laptops yet, but, you know, it's on the way. I didn't make this up. This is what the Sun Niagara would look like if you, you know, through all the threads and all the cores and put it in a laptop. Now, I'm not saying that's a good idea or, you know, anything, but it's worth thinking about. In 10 years, well, it's not even 10 years, in that many minus 2008 years, is that, are we going to see that? is that going to be what, you know, cat proxy view info, you know, 12 screens later? And with the caveat that they all won't be 10 times faster than your current single thread. So you'll have, you know, crap loads of them, but each individual one may not be that fast. I mean, it may be a bit faster. But so we have this, you know, and this is coming, I think. Other people think so. Now, there's sort of a progression there, you know, dual thread, quad core, or dual core, quad core, 8-core, blah, you know. And the cell is kind of like that, but it's a little bit different. You could draw it like this, but it's not really what it looks like. It's actually like this. And all that changed there is the names. The point is, you have a CPU, which is called the PPE, and it has two threads. And then you have eight or four, but let's say eight, other little CPUs, which are called SPEs or SPUs interchangeably, and they're different to the PPE. So it's multi-core, but it's heterogeneous. It's got two different types of cores. And it's got eight of those and one of those. But I think that's something that we could see more of. Little, you know, acceleration engines, XML processors in hardware, TCP offload stuff, you know. They'll think of crazy things. Crypto stuff, the Niagara has hardware crypto. So it's going to be, you know, more like this. Little engines that are good at doing certain things, but not necessarily everything. And on the cell we have the SPUs, which are really good at straight line vector code. They're kind of weird. They don't have, it's not a unified memory architecture. The SPUs have their own little memories, 256 kilobytes, and they have a DMA engine, which you can use to shuffle stuff in and out of main memory, which the PPE sees as its memory, you know, and that's kind of weird. It really makes you think about, hang on, how do I start to program this thing? And especially the current generation, you have 256 kilobytes of memory. It's not really a lot. We're used to like 2 gig machines. And I mean, there's a chance in the future we'll get a cell with 8 meg or 4 meg or a meg of local store, which would be cool. But it's still, you know, as that local store grows, the data sets you're working on are going to grow as well. So it's always going to be small. So I think this is where we're heading. You're not going to have a central processing unit. You're going to have a bunch of processing units that happen to be in the middle. But no single one of them is actually, you know, the CPU. And as programmers, I don't think we're quite ready for that idea. We're sort of stuck back on the first slide where there's a CPU. So maybe I'm crazy, but I think, you know, that's the way the industry's heading. And I'm a programmer, so if I want a job, I need to learn how to program these things. So yeah, like I said, I've been working on the cell kernel, but that just runs on the PPE, doesn't do anything interesting. We really need something that uses the SPUs, and we can, you know, write fairly simply and then start optimizing. I've always liked ray tracers. I used to like, you know, the demo scene back in the days, and I never actually wrote one because I was just a little weenie. Apparently everyone's written a ray tracer except for me, so now I've written one. It's not a very complicated ray tracer, but it's a ray tracer. So I mean, that was part of my motivation, but it's also a really good workload. It's embarrassingly parallel, which means it's really easy to make it parallel. And that's basically because every pixel is rendered, in the simple ray tracer anyway, is rendered independently of the pixel next to it. So in theory, you could render each pixel on a different CPU. And, you know, back in the old days, people probably did that on massive render farms. You all know what ray tracing is, right? Whoops. Okay. So it's like Shrek, you know, pretty graphics. It's importantly though, it's not Halo or whatever Wii games people like. That's a completely different technology. There's sort of commonalities, but ray tracing is not something we see in games very often. There's a few games. Someone wrote ray traced Quake, which is pretty crazy. I think you still need a few CPUs. Yeah, right. It looks cool, but yeah. A little bit, yeah. Actually, yeah, I should have talked about GPUs, you know, in that intro section. Because, yeah, GPUs are kind of like accelerators. People haven't thought of them that way, but they are. And, you know, they're going to start landing on the die instead of off on the PCI bus. And, yeah, there's definitely a... It's sort of a progression. You have, yeah, Core 2 Duo, which is totally general purpose, and the cell's kind of in the middle, and right on the end you have your GPUs, which can do something really fast, but you've got to bend your brain to make your program actually fit that model, you know what I mean? But I think, you know, with shader programs becoming more and more full-featured, it's all kind of coming together. Yeah, definitely. So ray tracing. In the real world, we have this thing called the sun. Photons come out of it. They bounce off things. They go in your eye, and that's how you see stuff. So that's not actually there. It's just there's photons coming off it. This is how the real world works, but in a computer that would kind of suck because there's basically an infinite number of photons coming out of the sun, and we'd have to track them all, and most of them don't go in my eye. Most of them go somewhere else, in your eyes and off the atmosphere. So ray tracing, we go backwards. We start at my eye, and we trace outwards, and we go, I'm looking at that, where are there any photons hitting it that could be coming into my eye? So it's just the reverse, and it makes the problem space tractable. So, you know, I can divide my eye into some number of finite number of pixels, and shoot a ray out of each pixel, and see what it hits. That's you guys. There's a picture later. They look like daggers. You're still ending up with a lot of rays, don't get me wrong, but it makes it feasible. So, and because it's sort of roughly based on physics, you get some nice stuff for free, like reflections and shadows, and I don't do it, but you can do refraction, like through water and glass, and, you know, the old glass pyramid with the rainbow coming through it, all that kind of stuff. Unlike your Halo technology where it's all, here's a whole bunch of triangles and splat them on the screen and then do all sorts of post-processing stuff to try and make it look like there's real light in the scene. So ray tracing is nice for that. So you kind of get all this stuff for free. I can't see whatever's behind that because the ray coming out of my eye can't hit it. So you get shadows, you get, I don't know if you know raster graphics, but graphics card has to draw things back to front so that the things on the front are actually on the front. But with ray tracing, you don't have to do that. It all just kind of falls out. It's really nice. So if you, like me, have never written a ray tracer, there's one for you. It's kind of Python, yeah. I like Python. I missed the damn keynote this morning, but anyway. So for each pixel, to start with, we haven't hit anything. Our ray hasn't collided with anything. And so we just go through every object in the scene, every one of you, and if the ray coming out of my eye hits you and you're closer than the guy behind you, then I see you. And that's the bit down the bottom. The pixel is the color of whatever I'm looking at. So the wall is white. That was a little bit simplified. But not too much. That is the core algorithm, except for this last bit. That's really where all the cool stuff happens, the lighting function. That's if you do the simple algorithm, you just get flat colors. So you're all white and you're all black, and you know, it doesn't look very realistic. But you can do a reasonably simple lighting function that actually makes things look kind of sort of normal, like a little bit anyway. But I'm not going to talk too much about that, because that's ray tracing theory stuff that I don't actually know much about. So we're going to write it on cell. I sort of mentioned that the SPUs are very different to the PPE, and they're so different, it's a different instruction set. So you need a new compiler. It's a different architecture. So that's kind of, you can't just make blah and run it. You need the SPU compiler. You need a runtime library. There's a fairly good support for that, but we're a bit limited. Notably, there isn't a Python interpreter that runs on the SPUs, funnily enough. So at the moment, as far as I know, there's C, C++, Fortran, and Ada working in GCC. Don't say it, Ada, yeah. I don't know, actually, yeah. No comment. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm a bit of a C programmer. So I chose C. Fortran, you know, has a reputation for being good for HPC stuff, but I don't know Fortran, so. Like I said, I like Python, and I've never written a ray tracer, so I started writing one in Python. And Python is almost pseudocode, so it's really good like that. And I did a bit of maths at uni, but not like double maths or anything. So Python has all these vector maths for you for free. It's really good. So we have a ray tracer. How cool is it? And it's really fast. I don't know. When I was a kid, I used to play with PovRay. I'm sure someone has. And it used to take days to render something like that. And that was like highly optimized C code, you know. So I was, you know, 3 minutes, that's not too bad. And, you know, we've got shadows, we've got spheres that look round, which is, you know, nice. We have reflections, which you just kind of get for free. You just trace the ray to there, and then you trace the ray to there and see if it hits anything else. And at some point you stop, because otherwise you go off to infinity. So I don't know, I was fairly impressed with that. Afternoon's work, a bit of help from Jeremy. Now, we're going to have to throw the Python ray tracer away, unfortunately. We're going to have to write one in C. And the first thing I really thought about was, we have this cell, it's many core, or multi-core, depending on if you're into buzzwords. We have to split up the rendering somehow. So the PS3, the chip has 8 SPUs, the hypervisor gets 1, and 1 is turned off, so they get better yields. So you have 6 for your user-space programs. This is under Linux on the PlayStation. IBM make these blades. Some of you might know them. They're called QS2122. Is it? I thought, yeah, okay, whatever. I don't think we'll sell you a 20, but anyway. And they have 2 cell chips, you know, soldered on the board. So you end up with, it's NUMA, you know, they're not soldered together, but on the machine you have 16 SPUs. So we need to split our ray tracer up. And there's a few ways we could do it. We could do a thread per pixel, like I was saying before. Theoretically, you could do that. I guess I kind of just ruined my next slide, but anyway. We could do the hit detection on one SPU and the lighting on another one. And that may be a good idea, but I'm not sure. The easiest option, because of this, is just to do if we have six SPUs, we have six threads. Each one renders 1/6 of the rows in the scene. So the top 1/6 and like that in strips. And that, you know, that's easy. I don't know if it's optimal though. There's literature around about the cell which says you're better off doing really small programs that do one thing really fast. And that's kind of not what I've done. So that's sort of like next year's talk. The other thing you could do, my scenes, some of them have a big blank area down the bottom where it's just like the floor, and that renders really fast. And so you end up with one thread taking half a second, but the thread in the middle that's doing all the spheres takes twice as long or three times as long. If you were doing a real ray tracer, you'd want to catch that, sort of measure that, and sort of divide the scene up into different sized blocks. So if this SPU took twice as long, give it half as much work for the next frame. And then hopefully, in the end, they all end up taking about the same amount of time. But yeah, you could do a PhD on that, actually. Hint. So we have a program that runs on the PPE, which kind of coordinates things. It's kind of like the central control processor. It's not meant to do much work, but it has to sort of coordinate everything. And that's what we do here. We load the scene for however many SPUs we have. We create a thread on the SPU. We wait for it to finish. And then we save the image. Pretty straightforward. On the SPUs, we DMA in the scene, and then we ray trace it. And then we DMA the picture back out. That's because our local store is not part of memory. That's a little tricky. When I was developing this, I was working on the PS3 sometimes and on the QS20s sometimes. And so I'd sometimes have six SPUs and some I'd have 16 and some I'd run with 8 or 2. And so it seemed to be working until, you know, this happened. I rendered a bigger picture and, yeah, it explodes basically. The error messages aren't that great. So if we want to render, I don't know if you know, the screens you get for PlayStation, they do 480p, 720p, the standard resolutions. 480p is 480 by 854, that many pixels, do the maths. We end up with 200 kilobytes of image in our local store. And our program is 70 kilobytes. And that adds up to more than 256 kilobytes. So that kind of sucked. And I didn't catch that for quite a while because I was doing little test renders. You know, 100 by 100 works, yeah. And then 2 weeks later, I do a big one and what? So that was the first gotcha. So we have to do this. We do a row at a time, DMA it out, render it, DMA it out. The DMA engines are really fast, but you can even, you know, you can double buffer. So you do ray trace a row, start the DMA for that, ray trace another row, wait for the first DMA to finish, you know, switch. And that way you basically, the DMA cost is zero. You spend all your time rendering, and while you're rendering, the DMA is happening asynchronously for you, because there's a little piece of hardware doing that, called the memory flow controller. It's the DMA engine. It's actually really awesome. It can do 16 DMAs at once, or sort of in flight. You can pump 16 DMAs into it and then go off and do something else. It has tags. You can say, I want to wait for those 4 DMAs and then these 4 DMAs and crazy stuff. It has scatter-gather support. So, if you have a contiguous buffer in your local store, you can splat it out to main memory or vice versa. Yep. There's one. Per SPU. Yeah, right there. Sorry, I didn't say that. Yeah, so you have 8 of these, and actually the PPE has one as well. So that's really powerful. Yeah, it's basically on the die, there's the SBU and its local store and the MFC, and there's 8 of them. Yeah.
The MFC actually contains a full MMU as well, because that's the recipe program lives in the address space of your Jerusalem application that passes through the point of
that. You shouldn't understand what he just said, because it's way too complicated. All you want to know is your user program on the PPE and the view of memory that your SPE app has are the same. They could be different, but that would be completely insane. So yeah, these MFCs are really, really sweet. But there's always a gotcha. It's a DMA engine, so it likes pumping around certain sizes of data. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, or multiples of 16, but 128 byte chunks is always optimal, and that's basically a cache line. It's not actually specified anywhere, but I think when you do a 4 byte DMA, it actually DMAs a cache line and then throws the rest of it away somewhere. So you don't want to be doing 1 byte DMAs. I mean, that should be pretty obvious. But there's also alignment constraints. If you're a HPC guy, you're all across alignment and strides and, you know, hitting your cache lines and blah. But for normal programmers, this is kind of newish stuff. So all your data structures have to be naturally aligned, which means if it's 8 bytes, it's got to be aligned to an 8 byte boundary, stuff like this. Sorry?
Not more than 60. If you have a 257 byte data structure, it doesn't have to be elastic by 257 bytes.
Correct. Yeah, no, that's true. 16 bytes is kind of the block size above 16 bytes. And this is a bit of a nasty one too. Your quad word offsets have to match, which basically means if you have a quad word up the top on your SPU and you want to ship it over to memory, but shift it, you know, that way a bit, you can't do it. Yes, sorry, yeah. Details. But basically, yeah, your source and your destinations have to be aligned on 16 byte boundaries and the same, you know. If you haven't done that, you enter hell, where every quad word you want to DMA, you have to shift it. Or you have to have arranged to have shifted previously or something. So you really want things to align. Because the DMA is basically, hey, go and DMA that, and you can do 16K at a time. If you have to do this, you've got to do a loop on your SPU for each quad word, shift it, DMA it. That's going to suck. Yep. Yes. I have a slide about that. Yeah, basically, we need to fix, or the error reporting there is not as good as it could be. It's mainly a user space problem, but yeah, you get a bus error, which is basically the DMA didn't work, go sort it out, yeah. I think there's some patches that went into a recent kernel that instead of a bus error, you're going to get a seg fault, and you can actually catch that and do something at least. So that'll make life a little easier for you Hackfest people. Now, I had this little problem. I don't know if you know much about graphics, but you generally RGB, you know, that's how monitors work, I think. You have a byte for your red and your green and your blue, and it comes out as pretty colours. And that's your 24 million colours. Some people do RGBA, A for alpha channel, so you can do transparency. But my ray tracer doesn't do transparency, so I don't need it, right? And it's a quarter less memory. That really screws everything right up real bad. And this is what I was talking about just before. So with 3-byte pixels, your rows don't necessarily start on same boundaries. So you tell that SPU to start rendering on the fourth row or the fifth row, and it's sort of you know, all whack. It's bad. So we could do that. We could do that. But we'd have to either change the rendering code so that it, as it's rendering, goes, oh, hang on, I'm meant to store at a weird offset and shift it and store it. Or as we DMA, we'd have to shift everything. So this is bad. And when you sort of do the numbers, it's totally not important. Even the worst case for sort of, you know, modern monitors is 1080p. That's sort of full HD, 1920 by 1080 pixels. It's a lot of pixels. 3 bytes a pixel, you know, you get about 6 megabytes. 4 bytes per pixel, you get 8 and a bit. And the time it takes to DMA that much is so tiny, you can barely measure it. So when my ray tracer really rocks, I might finally hit this limit, you know. But it's not like the human eye can even perceive that, so what's the point anyway? I guess if you're doing an offline renderer, that might be useful, but yeah. So DMA speed here is not going to hurt us for a long time anyway. Yep. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Sorry.
So you could just add that to 6 billion, add that to what we're
doing. Only if they're actually... You can start DMAing early and finish late, sort of have buffers around the end.
Yeah.
But if that's different to what you actually want... So if you're DMAing into the frame buffer, say, it has to land in exactly the right place. So, yeah. There are things you could do, but when you've got that much DMA power, it's just put the alpha byte in there and, you know. And that's not even mentioning, on the SPU, quad word loads and stores are much faster than pulling out things on weird, you know, the 3rd byte and the 6th byte. And so you're hurting yourself. Oh, there's instructions for doing that, but you have to do it to every quad word. Sorry? Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, the DMA engine won't do that for you. No. So, I mean, you can, on the SPU, you can do, there's an instruction to basically take any byte and put it anywhere else, but you have to actually do it. Ray tracing, it's all 3D maths. You should know that. And you all went to school. So, vectors, right? X, Y, Z defines a point in space and another point, and then you can do things with them. It's not really interesting. If you're interested, Google it. There's heaps of stuff about, you know, how to intersect a ray with a sphere and a plane, whatever. But it's really good that it's all vectors because the SPUs have vector registers. They're 128 bits wide. You can store in one, you can store 4 floats, 2 doubles, 4 ints or unsigned ints, and 16 chars. What? No. Not all at the same time. But you can flip between them. You can have something that is a float, and then you can just decide that it's an int now. And sometimes that's useful. If you're using it for chars, there's some instructions you can't do. So, yeah. Oh, yeah? Okay. So we've got these vector registers. We can operate on them, you know, all at once. So we can add, do 4 adds at once, basically. And we have so many of them. We have enormous numbers of registers. You know, this is not the x86, which has 2 registers. Now, in theory, you can have 512 float values, you know, in registers at any one time. In theory, you know, in theory, you're going to need a few for storing loop counters or whatever, but yeah. The compiler will use these. It has to use them. There's no other registers. But it's not that smart about it. So when I started, I had this struct vector thing, which it generated okay code, but if you instead, you can tell it, hey, this is a vector float, there's four floats in here, and it just generates better code. I'm not really sure why, but just do that. Oh, this is GCC, all with GCC, yep. Ray tracing, it's all about rays hitting other things, spheres, planes, more maths. So I started with these primitives, you have a plane or you have a sphere. And I learned object-oriented, I'm sure you did. So you have, this is like C, right? You have a type flag and a union. It's pretty ugly, but it works. And then your routines, your methods, look like this. That seemed like a really good idea. I didn't even think about it, actually. That's just how I write code. I've been brought up that way. The problem is, on the SBUs, you have no branch prediction. And missed branches hurt. And back here, this switch, we cannot predict that when we're compiling the code. The compiler has no way of guessing, hey, he's probably more likely to be intersecting a sphere rather than a plane. It can't know. It's got to guess. Chances are 50% roughly of the time it's going to be dead wrong, and we're going to hit this 18-9 cycle stall. The trick is, instead of looping through all our objects and then checking, is this a sphere? If so, do that. Else, do that. You, at the very top, you go, get all the spheres, for all the spheres, intersect with all the spheres. Then get all the planes. And that way you're doing the if once, and it's right at the top of you, sort of your nesting of code. It's not the original way it was. It's in the middle of your very hot loop, you know, which you do a billion times. So this is the tip you all needed for the Hackfest that we didn't tell you. There's this really cool tool, IBM do an SDK for Cell, and there's a really cool tool in there called Spew Timing. And it gives you a reasonably good, slightly rough, cycle accurate estimate of how your code's going to, your assembly code, sorry, how it's going to flow. And it tells you things about the processor, like, will it dual issue two instructions? That's basically, on one clock cycle, it can start two instructions. And it can't always do that. So if your code is always dual issuing, it's going to be a lot faster than if it's never dual issuing. And it also shows you stalls due to data dependencies and stuff. This is the kind of stuff it gives you. There's a GUI version as well, but that, I don't know. This works for me. This is kind of a before and an after, and I'll sort of talk about the after in a minute. But this is really bad. These dashes are stalls. Nothing's happening. And that's basically because over here, each instruction needs the result of the previous instruction before it can start doing anything. And there's not a lot you can do about that until you start getting a little heavier into the optimizing. But when you do, you want to see something like this. You've got an odd pipeline and an even pipeline, 0 and 1, and certain instructions can go on one and certain instructions go on the other. So this code is lovely because we've got an even instruction, an even, an even, an odd. So that's fine. And there's no data dependencies. So that just kind of goes fast. Okay. Now, to actually get that to happen, we really need to unroll our loops. And I know that's like HPC stuff, but that's kind of where it's at. The main reason is it gives the compiler more code to do optimization over. So if you're doing intersecting one sphere in your loop, it's a little bit of code, and there's massive data dependencies because it's all for one sphere. You need to know the result of the previous thing before you can do anything. If you do, say, 16 spheres in your loop, you know, you still write it, intersect the first sphere, intersect the second, third. But when the compiler gets all that code, it can kind of spread it out. So it starts doing the loads for the last intersection, you know, way before, and you get this lovely, it's really hard to read or debug, because you've got this routine down here has been sort of splattered up there, and vice versa. But that's how you get this beautiful, you know, fully pipelined code layout. This is a bit more HPC talk. You can either have your vectors X, Y, Z, W across, or you can store them X, Y, Z, W downwards. And this actually makes a big difference. Like I say here, AOS is really intuitive. That's how you, struct pixel. Whereas this is like you have an array of your X values and then an array of your Y values and then an array of your Z values. And it's kind of just a bit yucky. It's not, that's my object-oriented bringing up again, you know. It just doesn't look right. Talk to him. I'm using Jeremy's slide technology and I could not make this blank slide go away. Anyway, on to the next slide. So I did a whole bunch of optimizing, and it's sort of, this is a rough history. I had to kind of go back and pull this out of my Git tree and make it, you know, actually do the same benchmark throughout my development. And I also picked a dumb benchmark in hindsight. I did a 480p render on one SPU and one frame. And that's kind of the worst case because you do the full setup of your SPU program, you DMA the scene in, and then you render one frame, and then you tear it all down. If you're writing a real-time ray tracer, you do the setup once, and then you just render frames constantly. So I'd really like to do this again with, say, 100 frames and see what the average time is. So this is using struct vector. Then we told the compiler that it was actually a vector. Got a bit of a speed up. This is kind of a bit of a cheat, but lights don't shadow each other. Some renderers have that. This was big. That is the branch prediction. The switch statement, pulling that out got me like, you know, twice as fast. And this is 3 a.m. this morning. I got another 2x speed up. And that was unrolling another loop, giving the compiler more space to optimize. Bling. Okay. Very quick bling. All right, we'll just go with this guy. Can you guys see that? Oh, crap, I didn't delete all the frames. So, in the end, it rocks. This is rendered on the PlayStation after you guys finish the Hackfest.
The real-time speed?
No. No. I don't actually have the numbers. It's kind of maybe one frame a second or something like that. That's pretty high res. That's 1024x768. So you could probably get it going close to real time at 480p. Yeah. And there's LCA. Isn't that awesome? Okay. I just quickly want to plug, IBM actually have a real serious ray tracer. The LCA scene has about 300 spheres, I think, and two planes. They can do 300,000 polygons real time on a PlayStation, and they get linear scaling. If you plug a second PlayStation in, it goes twice as fast, and so on. But several man years of effort. Really cool, though.
Real ray tracer or a caster?
No, it's a ray tracer. That's it. It does ambient occlusion, all the cool stuff. It is very impressive. I don't know how they make it go that fast. I really don't. I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I'd also like to thank Jeremy for his XML slide goodness. Last time I did a talk, OpenOffice died on me, so this is good. Everyone at OzLabs who came and heckled, but they did put up with me bitching about this for months. The guys in Germany who we've been working with, and my girlfriend Meg, who put up with way too many me saying, I'm just going to stay up and work on my ray tracer. when she should have said, get to bed. No, it's been good. I have to show you this. Yep. And I think we might be out of time.
No, we have about 4 minutes for questions.
4 minutes. Okay, yep.
How much
effort
did it
take
to write the whole thing?
Ooh, not sure. I mean, it was an own time thing, so I just did it, nights and weekends. If I was working full time, probably only a couple of weeks. Yeah. Having said that, some of the optimizations, it takes you, you need gaps where you can think about it. Yeah. Yep. Yep. No. Fixed point? What's that? Are you crazy? No, I mean, you have instructions to do. No, it's blindingly fast. It would be as fixed point. Way faster, definitely. I definitely think so, yeah. Okay. Integer multiplies suck. Yeah. Floating multiplies fast. It's meant to do floating point, single precision floating point. But yeah. Sorry, you're next.
I was going to say, how hard is it?
I know. I did a lot of development on the blades, but someone here, it runs Linux. You can put Ubuntu or Fedora on it. You can yum or apt-get the compilers. It has a frame buffer. You know, pretty much. Yeah.
Was it purposely arranged that this talk was after the Hackfest had finished?
It actually wasn't, but it turned out fairly well, didn't it? Yeah. Thank you, someone. Who's next? Over here? Sorry, you've got a microphone. Yep, all right, you.
Just wondering if there's libraries for these SPUs.
There's some libraries. IBM have some to do kind of like, they call it accelerated library framework or something. So basically, you write code to run on the SPU, but you don't sort of think about it too much, and they do all the DMAing of data for you and that kind of stuff. There's a vector math library that comes in the SDK. I don't think it actually has a dot product, but it has everything else. Dot product's kind of hard, but it's not that hard to do. But there's an optimized, and it's also that one library is optimized for the SPUs, and there's a PPE version as well. So you can build your code to run on either with that library. Yeah.
When you're running on the on Linux on there, what's the performance out of the hypervisor?
It's not bad. The SPUs are basically bare metal. The hypervisor stops you from doing some things, but I think in terms of SPU performance, it's pretty much one for one with the bare metal. The Linux, you know, the user space Linux kernel stuff is a bit slower. The interface to the hypervisor disk driver is not that good, and a few things like that. But it's totally usable. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Oh, sorry, behind you.
Hey. In one of the earlier slides, you said that there was a problem you had when rendering the scene. You found that the lower parts of the scene were a floor or something, so they were very simple to render.
Yeah.
When doing the Hackfest, I found a solution to this is split the problem up into work units. So a work unit might be n pixels.
Yeah.
And then just farm them off to the SPUs as the SPUs finish whatever work they were currently doing.
Yep. That's what I was talking about, doing sort of an adaptive approach, yeah.
Oh, I see. Yep.
Yeah. Work units is okay, but you get a bit more overhead because you're DMAing small amounts of data. The way the IRT guys do it, I'm pretty sure, is they render a frame and they see how long each one takes, and then the next frame they adapt. So you're still doing big chunks per frame, but in between frames you kind of do a bit of fudging to, you know, so over the course of 10 frames it comes out at roughly balanced. No, I don't. No. Rusty?
What does SPE stand for?
It's a buzzword.
Oh, did I not tell you that? It's synergistic processing elements. That's why I like to call them SPUs. Because the buzzword guys don't like that.
I think that's about it, guys. Sorry, you can ask me questions after. So.
Yeah, I'll be around.
Okay, so.